Film Nerds Unlimited. Lo-fi movie conversations with high-quality movie connoisseurs. Ben Flanagan of AL.com. Ben Stark of Wonder Mill Films.
Ben, how you doing?
Good, Ben. Good morning.
So, a few days ago, I was getting excited for the summer movie season and a little bit relieved that, honestly, it's still, I mean, there still is a summer movie season because we still have the phenomena of the May opener. Next week sees the release of Guardians of the Galaxy, and that's a huge movie. It may be the biggest movie of the summer, one of the biggest of the year, and and Hollywood has still decided to open summer with a big splashy release in the first weekend of May. And I've always liked that tradition, and it made me kind of think about, you know, how long that's been a tradition and what years it worked out and what years it didn't at all. One of my one of the things I immediately go to was really anticipating summer 2004 for some reason, and the release of Van Helsing. Not because I really wanted to see Van Helsing that much, but just because I was so ready to see summer movies. And and boy, that movie is a classic, of course. You're equally obsessive about this kind of stuff, maybe more so than me even. So I thought you'd be a good person to talk to about the May opener for summer movies. Thought maybe we can just go from the beginning and kind of talk through all of them and how they were received and how they're how they maybe even affected the summer. So I guess the big thing is that in your research, you kind of discovered that really 1996 was the first year that this kind of thing happened, where the big summer release was pushed early into the month of May, and then B, that it really kind of, it was it wasn't an R-rated movie. It wasn't necessarily like a character comedy, which obviously those two things are very rare at summer movies nowadays anyway, but in the mid-90s a little bit more common. But it definitely kind of set the tone for big May openers to come. And so just kick off the conversation with what that movie was in 1996 and your thoughts on this whole thing.
Well, real quickly, it is interesting that the May opener concept didn't start until 1996, or it almost started in 1996. Like you said, with Twister, it opened May 10th, 1996. Yeah. The week before, several mainstream Hollywood movies opened. Barbed Wire, The Craft, The Great White Height, Dance with Sharon Stone, and The Paul Bearer with David Schwimmer. All of those movies opened that week. I'm guessing that The Paul Bearer and maybe Last Dance may have opened in select cities, but there were just kind of a late spring dump before the summer season got started.
Well, the director of Paul Bearer has a big summer movie this year. It's Matt Reeves, so maybe that should be counted as the big summer opener of that year.
Well, I think prior to 1996, it was all about Memorial Day weekend kicking off the summer season. So if you go back a couple of years, you'll see things like Die Hard with a Vengeance opened in the late May slot, and then you had stuff like Maverick and Beverly Hills Cop 3 and the Flintstones opened in 1994, late May 94. So it was really late May, once summer, I guess, was like officially getting started, that they really kicked off the summer movie season. But yeah, I mean, 1996 is where it really started in terms of what happens now. And you could even point to late April as sort of like the new summer kickoff in some ways, because you've got a movie, you've got the Fast and Furious franchise, which tends to open in late April. The Captain America movies, as of late, have opened in late April. So, you know, it's weird how the schedule seems to come sooner and sooner, but I call myself a traditionalist, even though this tradition started roughly 20 years ago. It was right in the middle of my childhood, and that's when I started going to movies on a pretty frequent basis, if not regular basis, especially during the summer. It's how I spent my time, and Twister was definitely a milestone in that. And what's interesting about Twister is it also sort of started this trend of the big movie opens May, and it also sort of opens on its own, and other movies don't really bother competing with it. And that might be a pretty time-honored tradition, but Twister on May 10th, 1996, opened against the Flipper movie with Elijah Wood and Heaven's Prisoners, this, like, Bayou thriller with Alec Baldwin. So Twister was on its own that weekend.
Yeah, and I remember the fun part of this when I was a kid was that you could start having conversations about movies while, like, school was wrapping up, you know? So it was, like, the end, like, throughout May, like, you know, the workload was getting lighter, the days were getting longer, and movies were out that we weren't talking about movies as much the rest of the year. And if we were, you know, it was more austere stuff, as I like to do with my friends, discuss Shine and whatnot. But I always remember that being like a fairly new thing. Like, wow, we're still in school and yet we're talking about Twister and Mission Impossible and these kind of early May releases. And that was fun. And I remember going back a little bit to 94, I remember the Flintstones being probably the first summer movie season starter that I remember. I remember because it was like the year after Jurassic Park, and I was like, okay, you know, like last year my life changed because of one of these movies, so this year I'm really going to pay attention. So what do I need to make sure I see? Oh, the Flintstones. That's essential.
It sets a big tone, too. You know, like the May movie now really sets a tone for how the summer might go, as we'll find out pretty soon. And Twister, it's on my personal top five of these big May openers because I thought it set a great tone. It still holds up as a really fun blockbuster, special effects-driven action movie, and a showcase, obviously, for the late, great Bill Paxton. And it showed that Jan de Bont was actually a pretty good big Hollywood summer blockbuster director when he wanted to be. And you know, we got a couple of examples of that, but Twister set the tone because you already mentioned a couple of the movies that came out. I mean, that was an enormous summer. It was a big summer for me going to see movies by myself a lot or with my brother Graham. But I mean, we would get The Rock and Mission Impossible and Independence Day and smaller, but still, you know, relatively big summer movies like A Time to Kill and Phenomenon and Hell, Eraser came out that same summer.
Yes.
So summer 96 is huge.
It's awesome. Yeah, that one felt like the first one for me, the first big season where it's like, okay, like, you know, there's so much out there. And I do think, I mean, there's so many of them were big PG-13 effects movies. And I feel like that's how we define summer blockbusters now, for better or worse. And that summer, I feel like that, you know, they had the fallout of Jurassic Park, and they decided, okay, well, now we've got this formula. As long as we have a PG-13 rating and a hefty effect budget, you know, we're safe to release this between May and August. So the next year was, I don't know, it's almost a little bit arguable for me, but I think, so the next year, I think the clear answer is probably The Fifth Element, right, in 1997.
Yeah, The Fifth Element opened on May 9th, 1997, and that's a week after there were a pair of big releases, both of which I saw, I think, on opening weekend on May 2nd, and that's Austin Powers, International Man of Mystery, which, like you said, was a surprise hit, and then Breakdown, the Kurt Russell thriller, which is
Jonathan
outstanding.
Yeah.
So that was huge, and The Fifth Element opened with another big summer release, but in a movie that ended up being a big turd critically and financially. It was a comedy, Father's Day, with Robin Williams and Billy Crystal. So The Fifth Element sort of had plenty of room to work with.
Well, it's just funny because, like, you know, now it's like obviously Austin Powers of that whole group there is the big one, but it certainly wasn't positioned as such. It was, I think that and Breakdown were more just kind of like late spring movies that happened to catch fire, or at least Austin Powers happened to catch fire. And then I think Fifth Element was probably the studio's, you know, attempt at positioning. But also, I mean, Robin Williams and Billy Crystal were enormous stars in 1997. So I remember Father's Day being a huge deal. And that was the movie that I had this art teacher who would always talk to us about movies. And she was like super snobby about her choices. Like, she made fun of us for watching Twister and liking it. and she ended up seeing Father's Day that weekend, and hating it. And I thought that was kind of funny that it was, you know, I think it's just universally panned. Oh, who directed Father's Day? Do you remember?
Ivan Reitman.
Ah, well, there you go.
Yeah, Ivan Reitman.
That was a formula. That was supposed to be huge.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus is the female lead. And this is so, like, you know, this is,
yeah,
like
this
the
is
height of Seinfeld.
Well, this is the end of Seinfeld, right? This is like right after it ended.
Right at the end of it, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Wow, that's bigger than Bruce Willis in a weird French action movie, in my opinion. But these days, absolutely, looking back, that Fifth Element, everything. I mean, Guardians of the Galaxy 2 looks just like the Fifth Element, in my opinion. So, yeah, you definitely see what would stick.
Yeah, and I didn't love the Fifth Element. I've gone back, and there's certainly a lot to appreciate about it. There's some really great action. The visuals are amazing, but for whatever reason, it didn't all come together for me. But that being said, it was definitely an interesting summer. I don't think that it was as good overall as 1996. But I mean, by interesting, I mean we got stuff like The Lost World, Jurassic Park. We got Addicted to Love, which was a nice counter programming for that. I guess Memorial Day weekend. There was Con Air, Speed 2, Batman and Robin, My Best Friend's Wedding,
Men in Black,
movie Hercules, and Face Off came out on the same weekend. And then Men in Black was the weekend after that. So it was definitely a big summer. But again, if I had to pick between 96 and 97, I'd probably still go 96.
Yeah, 97 was huge for me because it was like, you know, I had a job, or I was working more at least, and I had money. So it was like whenever I had any option of what I was doing with my time, it was going to the theater. I think I saw The Lost World several times, that's like the high water mark for that summer for me. Men in Black was huge. And again, Men in Black is just that perfect summer movie template, you know, big stars, big effects, breezy runtime. You know, that movie is like 90 minutes long and just like whips by. That was a big year for sure.
Yeah, think of this. Four straight weeks in a row. Here's what you get. One weekend, Batman and Robin and My Best Friend's Wedding. The next weekend, Hercules and Face Off. The next weekend, Men in Black. The next weekend, Contact. And then the next weekend, we get kind of a breath. We get kind of catch our breath because George of the Jungle and Nothing to Lose come out.
Hey man, I saw George of the Jungle in theaters. So that I didn't take a break. I didn't take a week off.
I did, and then Air Force One came out a couple of weeks later, and we got back on track. But then that's the summer I think I started to like understand the August letdown. You know, like because I saw Spawn on like the first day it came out on August 1st, and it was just it blew, man. And I was just I guess that's it. I guess that's the summer.
We got a group together to go see Spawn. Like it was an event for me. It was a really good summer. You mentioned something in there that I had a thought about. What was that before? What was the week before Contact? I was gonna say this is. I mean, in one summer you get Face Off and Con Air.
Yeah.
Like, what were we doing? Why weren't we more appreciative of what we were given?
Hey man, I was so pumped for Face Off because I had like just, Graham and I had just become obsessed and we had finally seen like Hard Boiled and The Killer for the first time, and so we just immersed ourselves in John Woo. But you know, we had seen Hard Target in the theater, but we didn't have like enough of an appreciation for him and his earlier work, but we saw those and we thought, wow, like Face Off's gonna be like the American version of Hard Boiled and The Killer, you know, and to an extent we kind of got that. I think it's probably John Woo's best American movie for sure, but man, oh man, like if it did nothing else, it gave me a greater appreciation for what John Woo did and could do.
Yeah. I mean, Nicolas Cage was my favorite actor at this point. And I think this was a period I wasn't even allowed to see. I wasn't allowed to see R-rated movies. So I think I marinated in the hype of Face Off and Con Air and Air Force One, but I don't even think I saw those. I couldn't see those movies in the theater.
Did you sneak into R-rated movies at all?
I think I did one or two, but not those. So I think I was like, I just like inundated myself with the trailers, and I was so familiar with John Woo, and like I knew that he was probably my favorite director, but I don't even think I had seen any movies of his. I think I just like put together, or maybe me and my friends rented one or something. But this was also at the time I was working on this movie with my friends, and it was like 100% guys jumping in the air with two guns in their hands. So it was like, clearly I was being influenced by John Woo and without having seen his full movies, even though I knew exactly who he was and what he was doing. So yeah, that's a pretty torturous experience now that I think about it. Just enjoying that from afar.
Yeah. I was way too scared to sneak into R-rated movies. I was the little brother who just couldn't do it and would watch my brother.
Well, you didn't have to, because your parents would take you to Goodfellas.
Well, that's true, but we still had some limitations, and so like even during like 95 and 96, Graham would sneak into some R-rated movies. Like he went and saw From Dusk Till Dawn. He went and saw. I think he bought a ticket for The Hunchback of Notre Dame and went and saw Striptease by himself. So he
both,
had more.
Both Demi Moore movies.
Some,
so
he had
like
more
he could like
I did.
At the end, you know.
Yeah.
When like, he gets home, he can just say, well, Demi Moore was good. So
yeah.
Your parents would be like, oh, he must have seen Hunchback.
That's true. Yeah, great voice work. Uh-huh. We've reached a point where our parents are just like, screw it. They're just going to do it anyway. You know,
yeah.
Like, we'll just trust them. But that's a whole other episode.
Yeah, absolutely. That's its own episode. So the next summer, I feel like Deep Impact was probably the big one. That's the one I remember everybody going to see. However, I feel like there's other releases there that could be arguable.
Not really arguable.
No?
Because Deep Impact opened May 8th, 1998, and the week before saw the releases, the wide releases of Black Dog, the Patrick
yeah.
Swayze truck driving movie, and the Spike Lee movie He Got Game, which was a Touchstone release, so I assume that went wide, but I wouldn't characterize either of those as a big summer blockbuster. So you're right. I think Deep Impact is probably the go-to there, and it's not the last big asteroid summer movie we're going to get that year.
Yeah, well, for me that year it was Godzilla. Like Godzilla was like everything
yeah.
else was.
It was the Memorial Day movie. We were still
yeah.
in school when Deep Impact. Like you could judge this by when were we still in school? You know, like, what's the movie that like led us out of school and let us get to summer and start watching these summer movies? Godzilla was definitely that in 1998.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah, that was...
And it ate shit.
I still have a weird, weird affection for that movie. I loved it walking out. It was, I mean, the effects, the raptors, basically. The
soundtrack.
Oh my God, that Puff Daddy, Jimmy Page song, that Rage Against the Machine song totally holds up, by the way.
Maybe I don't even know what it was.
It's No Shelter, maybe my favorite Rage Against the Machine song. It's on my...
Strictly
on my
because of the... It was on the soundtrack, right?
Yeah, oh yeah. Why else? But what's funny is that there's a lyric in that... I think it goes like Godzilla pure M&F'n filler. I guess I just don't want the explicit tag on the podcast. But it's like, wow, here's a movie that's on – here's a song that's on this movie soundtrack, and in the song they talk about how the movie itself is just this, like, mindless consumption driven to distract us from the real problems in the world. So that wouldn't happen nowadays, I guess. But Yeah, I remember Godzilla being a big deal, and I had a blast with it. I guess Armageddon was really close to that, wasn't it?
Armageddon actually came out early July, so like July
4th. July, oh, okay, all right.
And you know, 98 was a really weird summer movie season. Like, it had some really good movies, but you saw sort of a sea change for what blockbusters could be, because you got movies like The Truman Show, and you got movies like a movie like 6 Days, 7 Nights, which was billed as a big summer movie because it was Harrison Ford and there was action and adventure, but it's a really strange little movie directed by Ivan Reitman that
a bad movie.
I love that movie. It's really good.
I hated
it. You had Mulan, which was the big Disney movie, but was putting a traditional Disney princess in the role of action hero. You had the X-Files adaptation, and then later on you did get big summer movies like Armageddon and Lethal Weapon 4, but then you had something like Saving Private Ryan, which was this insanely intense and super reverent World War II, R-rated World War II movie that still made a lot of money, but again, that's not what you would typically think of as a big, fun summer blockbuster, yet somehow it worked out that way.
Well, it's definitely a throwback. I mean, a few years earlier, Braveheart had been a big summer release. So it was still the time when you could release, and a few years later, The Patriot would be.
Well, The Patriot and Saving Private Ryan are very different things. You could say the Saving Private Ryan definitely paved the way for something like an R-rated, quote-unquote, war movie like The Patriot to come out, but I think you're talking about two very different experiences in terms of how the reality of, like, those, you know, in Braveheart, too, for that matter, which, was one of my all-time favorite movies. Love Braveheart, but it's a big, I see that way more as a big blockbuster than I do Saving Private Ryan, despite Saving Private Ryan's box office and the fact that it's directed by Steven Spielberg. I mean, that, I think you can put Saving Private Ryan in the same box that Schindler's List is in, more so than you can Jurassic Park.
More so than that, but I might put Braveheart more in the Schindler's List category. Because they're both tragedies, you know? I mean, I think it's a big, violent
tragedy. They're tragedies, but Saving Private Ryan, way more rooted in reality in terms of depicting, like, the horrors of a war that was much more recent and much more fresh in our minds. And, you know, and I know that it plays with it does its own job in terms of, like, how it distorts the truth and actual history. Braveheart, as much as I love it, is sort of infamous at this point for how much creative liberty it took with history. So,
well,
I don't
yeah,
know.
But yeah, I don't know, but it's still, I don't know. I still think it, because I remember the big conversation coming out of Braveheart was like, wow, how, like, realistic and ugly were those battle scenes? Which is the same conversation that came out of Saving Private Ryan. So
I don't know. Like,
yeah,
during the opening of Saving Private
Ryan,
Saving Private Ryan, I'm, like, scared and cowering and, like, oh my God, I can't believe this actually happened. I'm watching Braveheart, and look, it was 3 years ago, and I'm a teenager for sure, and I was 11 when I saw Braveheart, or maybe even younger than that. But I remember just thinking, this is badass. You know, like, I love this.
No,
it's
I remember
things I've ever seen. I didn't feel that, like, while I loved Saving Private Ryan
awful.
Just as much, I didn't have the same feeling.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see, like, 500 years to see how people watch these two movies, because I feel like they're doing the same thing. It's just the only difference is one took place in the generation, you know, within a few generations of us, you know, two people that we could talk to and love and are related to. So
yeah.
I think that's probably the difference. But anyway,
do you want to hear the August letdown of 1998 real quick?
Well, before that, I just to clarify something, is something about Mary in the Summer that year?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe
okay.
It was. It may have been like, it opened in July.
Yeah, okay, because that was the one for me. That was the one that year that I watched.
Oh, yeah.
I probably watched that movie six times in the theater, snuck in every single time. So there was a big difference, I guess, in my morality between 97 and 98, because I just stopped listening to my parents. And it was probably that Rage Against the Machine song that did it.
I saw something about, there's something about Mary on a double feature with the X-Files movie.
Oh, man, the 90s. I'm telling you, it was a better time.
Okay,
so what about those August sinkers?
Yeah, the quick August letdown. Halloween H2O, Snake Eyes, the Avengers, but not really the Avengers. Blade, which I guess was, you know, a breath of fresh air to an extent, I guess, looking back. Dead Man on Campus, Wrongfully Accused, in 54, that Studio 54 movie.
The next Boogie Nights. That's how that was positioned.
Oh yeah, that's right.
Snake Eyes, being a huge Nicolas Cage fan at the time, and after Mission Impossible, a big Brian De Palma fan, and I watched The Untouchables between there somewhere too. I was hyped for Snake Eyes.
Yeah.
I think that movie holds up. I mean, obviously the last act or so is weird and messy and goes some strange directions. But I think overall, I think it's not top level De Palma, but I think it's somewhere in the middle.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's go from there. All right. So
this isn't a Snake Eyes podcast.
Like Dark. The next year, I feel like, was definitely the year when Hollywood realized that they had something, because it started a trend with this filmmaker, and that's The Mummy opened the summer, and it was a huge, hugely anticipated summer with obviously The Phantom Menace, but also to a certain degree, I think, Austin Powers 2. Like, I remember there being an enormous amount of anticipation for that from at least my demographic. But it was, The Mummy was this like primer, you know. I felt like it was like this, like, we know you're going to get Star Wars and that's what you really want. But guess what? We've got something ahead of time that's a pretty good appetizer for that. And it ended up being better than the Star Wars movie. And then it also started this kickoff of Stephen Sommers being kind of the king of the May opener for just one other time, and then a failed attempt later on. Do you remember how huge The Mummy was, or at least how big it felt after you saw it?
After I saw it, for sure. Like, I wanted to see it.
Yeah.
I went and saw it, I think, the day it came out at the Cobb, or I'm sorry, the Fox 12 in Tuscaloosa. And I watched that. I laughed my head off. I thought the action was so good and the visual effects were so cool. I walked out of that thinking, like, wow, that was way better than maybe it should have been, or way better than I thought it would be. And I loved The Mummy, and I still love The Mummy. It's still one of my favorite summer movies ever. And I can't remember if I saw it twice, but I should have. I guess, like, after I saw that, I had the feeling of, like, wow, if that was that good, let's just, like, you know, let's pace ourselves for how good The Phantom Menace is going to be. Because,
yeah,
Lord Daddy.
I know.
But I love The Mummy, for sure.
Yeah, it was one where nobody was really, I guess it wasn't a big anticipation thing, because The Matrix had just come out too, so people were still talking about The Matrix, and then The Mummy came out, and it was like, everybody was like, that was awesome. So
yeah.
It's like you have The Matrix, and then you have The Mummy, so it's like, well, let's finish this off with The Phantom Menace, and we'll have some really great, these three really great, you know, kind of summery action movies.
Yeah,
and it worked
and
out.
The Mummy came out May 7th in 99. It opened with Election, but I'm guessing Election was probably in select cities, so I'm guessing The Mummy was on its own that weekend, and it was a big hit.
Right, and then that summer also, was Austin Powers in May?
No, Austin Powers was early June.
Okay. I right that it was like, wasn't that a hugely anticipated?
Big time.
I think our whole
big
youth
time.
Group went to see it. For some
that seems
reason.
Like a good youth group movie, for
yeah.
sure. But
yeah,
you know, Austin Powers was big. Tarzan was a big, highly anticipated movie. Adam Sandler was really coming into his own as a big star. Big Daddy came
Big
out that
Daddy.
Year.
Yeah,
the South Park movie was coming out, and then the big, hugely anticipated, but probably the biggest dud of the summer, Wild Wild West, came out later in June
Ooh.
Or early July. And that sort of gave way for American Pie to have a big moment, and then Eyes Wide Shut came after that. So that was a big deal. July was actually pretty thin outside of American Pie, Eyes Wide Shut, and Blair Witch Project came out, but that I think August is where that really flourished. So yeah, July 99 was pretty quiet by Hollywood standards.
Here's where we're at as a culture. A R-rated Stanley Kubrick movie about sex was highly discussed as a summer movie. Like, I remember that being like on the tip of everybody's tongues. You know, that was the most talked about movie, you know, in the weeks leading up and following its release. That's crazy.
Well, Tom Cruise was a megastar.
True.
And, you know, he was gonna do it on screen with his also megastar wife, Nicole Kidman. So, you know,
is it real?
People
Are they
can't
really
help
doing
themselves.
It?
People can't help themselves, you know. And so it had, you know, it had a lot of capital in that. You know, Tom Cruise was in it, and so that was gonna do it favors. it's opening weekend, but once people saw it, I remember we were in the Bama Six in Tuscaloosa seeing that movie on its opening weekend. There were a lot of people there. I think Graham was joking, like, people think Tom Cruise is going to hang from ceilings in this movie, like Mission Impossible, and that's just not what's going to happen. So,
yeah, he might have.
It was much different from that. Like, yeah. But I love that movie. I love it.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Great movie.
I was 14 when I saw it in the theater, too.
Dear God. Yeah, I remember I rented it, like, later in high school, I think, and felt like the biggest pervert. I wanted to see it because it was the Kubrick movie everybody was talking about. I promise. And when I rented it from the Blockbuster, I mean, I'm sure the people working there were like, oh, this kid, gross. It was terrifying. I remember, I mean, obviously, it's not the, you know, sensationalistic, fun sex movie that everybody wanted it to be, maybe. It's a much more restrained and responsible movie in many ways, and scary movie in many ways. I remember that summer, like, starting so great and then, yeah, fizzling out. And this was towards the period where I started to stop paying attention to movies in a little bit. And I feel like, I wonder how much Phantom Menace had to do with that, you know, of... Like, that was, like, the ultimate summer movie that I was anticipating. And then while I liked it, everybody hated it. And it wasn't, like, I couldn't really even talk about it to anybody. And it was just like, oh, movies aren't fun anymore because we all hate them now, right? So for the next few summers, I was kind of, I was paying attention just passively. And so the next year, I don't even think I saw Gladiator in the theater at all. And that was the opener that year, right?
Yep, May 5th, 2000, it opened on its own. There was this other movie, this Kim Basinger movie, I Dreamed of Africa, that opened, but I think that was Salt Lake City.
What? Never heard
yeah.
of it.
I was so pumped for Gladiator because, like, it we hadn't had, like, one of these Roman Colosseum or Gladiator movies in a long time, and Ridley Scott was obviously a great director. I was hyped on Russell Crowe's being this next big superstar, which he obviously was as a result of it. But for whatever reason, Gladiator, while I thought it was good, it left me a little cold. And I think it's because I, like, immediately thought this is going to be like Braveheart, but with Roman, you know, like in the Roman
sandals.
Yeah. And like it didn't really live up to that. I might have thought, you know, I was young and dumb, obviously, and I might have thought that it was going to be just like two straight hours of like gladiator fights, you know, and it's not what it was. Obviously, it was basically like a war movie and a very politically minded movie. And looking back, it was on TNT or something recently or AMC, and I watched it. And I thought, man, this movie's awesome. Like, it's just really
it
fun,
is.
And Russell Crowe just is a huge star, clearly, and yeah, that it's aged really well for me, but for whatever reason, back then it left me cold.
Yeah, it's one that when a few years later I kind of snapped out of my movie malaise, I went back and kind of watched some of the more hyped movies I had missed out. Whenever I watched it, I was like, this movie rocks! Put in the DVD again. I was a huge fan of that movie once I actually caught up with it. But yeah, I remember the most common conversation I had coming out of it with some of my friends was, in the trailers, they have, like, cut between, like, modern-day footage and Gladiator footage, like, saying
right.
It's just, like, football. And I guess it was probably just one of my friends. He was like, there's no football in that movie. Like, there's like, no modern-day footage. And so, like, why do I care about these gladiators?
It was in the trailer.
I was like, I think you missed the point of the trailer.
The conversation I was having going in and coming out of it was, who would win in a fight, William Wallace or Maximus?
Maximus. Yeah, and also I was huge into pro wrestling at the time, so it's like, well, why would I watch a Gladiator movie when, you know, I could just turn on TV and watch actual fighting, real fights? So what else did we have that summer?
Next week we had Battlefield Earth, which turned out like it did. And then the actual big summer movies, we had Dinosaur, the Disney movie. We had Road Trip. What snapped me out of my Gladiator funk was Mission Impossible 2, which really might be the best John Woo movie in the Hollywood system. I don't know. It's
the best remake of Notorious that I've
That's
seen.
True. Very true. The next week we had Shanghai Noon, which was a nice little surprise.
Yeah.
Big Mama's House. Gone in 60 Seconds, which I will defend Gone in 60 Seconds, okay?
It's a really
fun movie. It comes on TNT every other week, and I think it's pretty good. Fantasia 2000, Shaft, Chicken Run, Me, Myself, and Irene. You mentioned the Patriot earlier, The Perfect Storm, which to me is ridiculous. And then in July, we have the first X-Men movie, which I think was a big deal looking back. And What Lies Beneath, The Nutty Professor 2, and then August comes and we start to peter out with stuff like Coyote Ugly and The Replacements. So, yeah.
Yeah, that was such a dry summer. And even X-Men, which I was highly anticipating, and which is a good movie, I remember walking out of it being like, did they spend about $50 million on it, and that's it? Because it's like, that movie feels so small and so cheap. But at the same time, it's like, I mean, I mentioned pro wrestling earlier, and I'm about to make a deep, deep reference. X-Men showing up on the scene is like stunning Steve Austin in 1991. You know, it's like this thing is going to be huge someday, and it's just showing up. It's this Marvel machine showing up and saying, hey, hi, I'm wearing a name tag. My name's Marvel, and you know, I'm not going to make a fuss. I'm just kind of hanging out.
We really had no idea,
decade.
Did we?
Yeah.
We had no idea what was coming. Like, it was just like, oh, cool, comic book movies out. All right.
Yeah.
Maybe there'll be more of those.
Yeah, and it wasn't anything like X-Men. You know, it's like Wolverine isn't wearing yellow. He doesn't have a mask.
Yeah.
17
years later, man. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
17
Lord
years
Almighty.
Ago. That's unbelievable. So...
He still has worn
yellow
spandex, which is BS.
They've joked about it. You know, when they're in their throwaway line in there, like,
yeah,
you'd
rather, absolutely.
You'd rather be in yellow spandex or something?
Yeah. Yes, is what I screamed in the theater. all right.
It
so could have
been
next...
Doug Ray Scott, man. Let's do a what Doug Ray Scott's career could have been like episode, Jim.
And yeah, I mean, we've talked about Mission Impossible 2 plenty of times. But that was another notch on my belt in terms of disappointments, where I was just like, I've got another. I was so hyped for this. You know, by this time I'd actually watched John Woo movies from Hong Kong, and I was on the Tom Cruise train. And Mission Impossible 1 was one of my favorite movies. And then I watched it, and I was like, I don't like it. And I was like, guys, pro wrestling is so much better than movies. Why am I wasting my time with these garbage movies that keep letting me down? And again, but
no.
I mean, I agree that looking back, it's certainly not as bad as I thought it was at the time, but it certainly wasn't as discussed. You know what I'm saying? Like, people moved on very quickly, and I feel like that was probably a lot of my disenchantment during this time, where it's like, well, a few years ago we had Jurassic Park and Men in Black and Mission Impossible and these movies that we would talk about for months and months and months after, and now it's just like these movies that are, it's all hype, we watch them and then we forget about them, and then we're like, oh, is Road Trip next week? And so I feel like there was just this, I don't know, just everything felt less special, I guess, which is going to happen when things are formulated and strategized the way that they have been.
Well, and when you're getting a little older, too.
Yeah, I was totally a jaded 16-year-old at this point. So so the next year is still, I think, probably the worst summer movie season in history. Of course, we've talked about it as well. It's 2001. What kicked off 2001? Oh, yes, it was the second Stephen Sommers. It was when Stephen Sommers thought he was Marvel, basically, and said, I am the early May guy, and here's my Mummy sequel. The Mummy Returns, which I saw twice.
Oof,
because
man.
My friends wanted to. I didn't like it. It may have been the first movie that like I knew I didn't like and just went to go see again the second time because it's real bad.
Yeah. To be like Oliver Harper, I'll say May 4th, 2001 saw the release of The Mummy Returns. And it opened on its own too. It was They had no competition, and I think this is probably the worst May opener ever. And
wow.
I say that as an enormous Mummy one Mummy fan. I love that movie so much, and I thought this was going to be incredible. I mean, like, it just, Stephen Sommers was back, the whole cast was back. It seemed to have the same exact look of the first movie, and then it totally blew up in our faces and sucked.
Well, but there was something else. There was something else that made it special.
Oh yeah. That's, so this was a big crossover for you. It blended your two universes.
Yep. Absolutely. It was hugely anticipated for me. And I think actually that opening sequence is probably the best thing in the movie. Just kind of like, you know, big battle scene with the rock and sand, and it's got sand, you know. So yeah,
sand,
I thought
it was good on film, man.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I was excited for it, and then, you know, it doesn't take long for the movie. I feel like it's like that bus chase is probably where it really sinks in, where you can't really tell what's going on. It's just these CG things crawling all over a bus in London. And I think that's about the point where I was like, okay, it's happening again.
I got snapped out of it pretty quick the next week with The Knight's Tale. I thought that movie was just like a really super surprising and refreshing summer movie. It didn't feel like it felt like it should have come out in like September or something, but it really worked well for me. Like, and it made me feel a lot better about The Mummy Returns, and it gave me new hope and promise for what summer 2001 would bring, and I knew that it would get just even better.
Well, I probably should have seen that because I didn't, and the summer was it never improved for me. So I still haven't seen A Knight's Tale.
It's really good. Brian
Hedlund. I feel like I could probably just turn on like TBS or something and it'd be on there right now. It just seems like one of those movies that it's impossible that I've missed at this point because it's just always on somewhere, but I haven't seen it.
Yeah, so like I said, it gave me new hope for what 2001 would bring that summer, and then it crapped all over those hopes with movies like, I don't like Shrek, I don't like it, and so I counted among the reasons that it's the worst summer movie season ever.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
The next week, Pearl Harbor, just nope. An absolute, yeah, and to get very highbrow here, one of the biggest turds ever for like many reasons. Then you have stuff like Evolution, another Ivan Reitman movie.
Yeah,
Ivan Reitman keeps coming up.
He's not great.
Swordfish.
The
big Disney movie that year was Atlantis, the Lost Empire, which just arrived, returned to Netflix.
Somehow we didn't mention Titan A.E. the summer before.
Oh, because it wasn't worth mentioning, I guess. So Laura Croft, Tomb Raider comes out that year, Dr. Dolittle 2, a big movie in retrospect now that set off an enormous franchise, came out June 22nd,
yep.
Fast and the Furious. So that's interesting to look back at how like small that kind of felt back then and what it's become today.
Isn't it interesting that The Rock's movie career started the same summer as Fast and the Furious?
That is interesting.
Means nothing but notable.
Yeah. AI came out that late June. Next in July, you had Cats and Dogs, you had Scary Movie 2, the Final Fantasy movie, Legally Blonde, Jurassic Park 3, Planet of the Apes. And then you had the typical August letdown with stuff like, you know, Rush Hour 2, I think, has its fans out there. American Pie 2 was definitely a drop down from the first one. Osmosis Jones was this weird, like, concept movie that just, like, whoa, what happened there?
I literally haven't
thought
of that
little horror movie. But then you just have these little tiny movies like American Outlaws, Captain Corelli's Mandolin, Rat Race. Jay and Silent Bob Strike Back was one of the bigger movies of August.
It was. I remember me and my friends were pretty hyped for it for some reason.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's
didn't
such
like
a brutal.
Yeah, 2001 is as brutal as we remember it, so we should probably just move on.
Well, I just remember the only thing I'll say about that summer is I remember like reading like a summer preview going in, and you know, AI was pitched as one of the biggest movies of the summer, and it's something that I don't think I even realized until just this moment. I was mad at Spielberg, I think, during this period of time, because You know, I love The Lost World. I didn't see Amistad. I didn't see Saving Private Ryan until DVD. And then even then I was like, well, that's good. But, you know, it didn't, like, strike a chord with me. And so I was just like, so instead of, like, making another good Jurassic Park movie, and then I saw, you know, that Jurassic Park 3 was being handed to Joe Johnston. And I was like, so instead of making us the Jurassic Park sequel that I want, you're going off and making all these, like, art adult movies. And, like I thought we were friends, man. You know? So it was a strange summer. And I didn't see AI. I totally skipped AI. I was like, whatever, man. I'll go see Jurassic Park 3 and love it. And then I hated it. And then it's like, man, movies are awful. I hate movies. This was the year when movies just hurt me bad.
I like Jurassic Park 3.
It's good. It's fine. Yeah, looking back, it's not the disaster that I felt it was when I walked out of the theater. But you see the state of mind I was in.
Yeah, I could win. Jurassic Park 3 is probably like the B movie that people thought Jurassic Park might have been on paper, you know? Like when it was like, wait, you mean like dinosaurs are attacking humans and we're supposed to take this seriously in 1993?
Yeah.
Okay, well, oh, but it's Steven Spielberg, so there's going to be a lot more to it, you know? So
yep.
I think Jurassic Park was like, you know, that's what people maybe thought they were going to get with that first movie, and then the first movie happened.
So something special happened after the egregious summer of 2001. And it was called The Lord of the Rings, The Fellowship of the Ring, which is where I personally kind of got back into movies, and my hope was restored. And following that, I think we got after 2001, it seems like the summer movie season kind of found its footing again, too, with that we mentioned X-Men kind of was a rumbling, and then Marvel really stepped up to the stage and took things over as they took over May in the summer of 2002 with Spider-Man, which is, I mean, for a long time, it may still be, even, I'm not sure, is the biggest May opening ever. Am I wrong?
That's probably right. I remember being pretty astounded by the number. I don't know if that number still holds, but it made $114 million, and I believe that was a three-day weekend. I could be wrong, but I just remember seeing that and just thinking, like, that's not possible. That doesn't happen. That, seriously, like,
yeah.
That doesn't happen because, like, I even at that age, I paid attention to the weekend box office results, and
yeah.
I tried to keep tabs on it, and you know, I was familiar with big weekends, you know, with some of the movies we've already talked about thus far, but I remember when Spider-Man came out and seeing that number, and I couldn't believe it. And I guess in retrospect now, we can say, like, that's the birth of what we know today as the comic book wave of, whoa, like, we can make this kind of money. And you said it took back the summer and kind of took over the summer. I mean, in a way, it kind of took over blockbuster movies as a whole, because you had mentioned...
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings, Two Towers came out this same year. Spider-Man outgrossed it. And this was when Lord of the Rings was a sensation. Star Wars Episode II came out, and it finished third at the box office. So Spider-Man beat Star Wars, too. And, you know, maybe Lord of the Rings, it got you back into the movie. It got you back into movies, and people loved it so much. Maybe because we just kind of felt so burned by Star Wars, you know, and by the prequel. At that point, and we were itching for something kind of like it, a sci-fi or fantasy trilogy that gave us the same feeling that the original Star Wars trilogy gave moviegoers and movie fans. So, and again, another podcast, but Spider-Man beat both of them, which is insane, because while comic book movies were, you know, to an extent commonplace by this point, this was a game changer.
Sure, yeah, really, up to this point, it was Batman movies, and that's it. And then you had, you know, a Blade or an X-Men movie or just the first X-Men movie, or, you know, Spawn, as we mentioned. But really, I mean, up to this point, really, the big moneymaker was really just Batman in terms of superheroes. So, and, you know, there's plenty in Spider-Man that takes from the Batman formula. So, you know, they definitely played it safe in many ways, but it's still, yeah, I feel like this is a huge turning point. It's a turning point for me personally. But yeah, I think also just for blockbusters in general, this is it. And really, I mean, you look at the list of May openers, and then also just in the same breath, you know, the biggest grossing summer movies since then, and it's like, yep. I mean, they're all Marvel movies for the most part, or at the very least, most of them are superhero movies, and that's huge. And it's crazy how quickly it went from, well, we got Blade, we got X-Men, and then boom, we got Spider-Man, and we're off to the races.
Yeah, and from this point on, it's going to be pretty common for comic book movies to open summers. They're going to pretty much stick to that May opener slot. And it actually opened with Deuces Wild, which is like this, like, you know, 50s, like, Rumble gang type deal with, like, Stephen Dorff and Johnny Knoxville. And then Woody Allen's movie Hollywood Ending, which had a fairly limited release. But Spider-Man absolutely obliterated its competition. It finished with $400 million domestic. And that's still a big deal now.
Yeah, absolutely. I remember it felt like a huge event, you know? And for better or worse, that freaking Nickelback Saliva mashup song was everywhere. And, you know, it was just, it felt like, it felt the same way that it felt when, you know, a big movie came out when we were kids. You know, it felt like we were back to kind of like the Twister thing where everybody is talking about this movie and, you know, it's on the radio and people are talking about that iconic kiss between the upside down kiss thing. And it's just like, yeah, I feel like it captured the zeitgeist in a way that a movie hadn't in a while. At the time, I loved it, but I felt like it was missing something as a huge Spider-Man fan. And since then, it hasn't aged well for me. Where are you at on Spider-Man these days?
I like it. I went back and watched it a couple of years ago, and it's fine. You know, growing up a big Marvel Comics fan and Marvel, just like a fan of the heroes, it was kind of surreal for me seeing Spider-Man on the big screen, like realized so perfectly, at least that character in particular. Like, the costume design was amazing, and I couldn't believe that it was happening. Like, I had no idea, obviously, that we would get the Marvel Cinematic Universe in the way that we had, but, you know, I didn't love the movie the first time I saw it. I kind of hated the design of the Green Goblin and sort of the direction they went with that. But Willem Dafoe is, like, really, really fun in it, and just, like, the look of the movie is pretty fun. It does have some goofy spurts here and there. It has a wrestling crossover with Macho Man Randy Savage making an appearance, so that makes us both happy. So, you know, it's fine. It's good. I don't know if between that and the second one, it's the best of that series. I wouldn't have any problem with that. And it's cool that it gave Sam Raimi an opportunity to play with such an enormous budget to see what he could do. I think he made the most of it for the most part.
Yeah, I feel like also that's worth mentioning. I mean, within a span of about 6 months, we had Peter Jackson and Sam Raimi, you know, delivering the two biggest blockbusters of the period. And it wasn't George Lucas or Steven Spielberg that was delivering those, or a, you know, a kind of a Hollywood staple like Steven Sommers or somebody like that. You know, it felt like I don't know. I feel like it wasn't the old classic blockbuster guys like Lucas or Spielberg or Zemeckis, and it wasn't the Hollywood standby guys like Rob Cohen or Steven Sommers, like I mentioned. This was these two schlock horror movie guys that got handed these tremendous franchises and made the best of them and basically took over the culture. And I mean, we're still seeing the effect of that now. James Gunn, you know, this guy that came from Troma Films has the biggest, you know, the big May opener this year. So, yeah, I feel like it was a turning point for all those reasons.
Yeah, you know, I think worth noting, you mentioned Sam Raimi directed the top grosser that year. Peter Jackson directed the second top grosser that year. Barry Sonnenfeld directed the eighth top grosser that year in Men in Black 2. So, you know, it, yeah, Men in Black 2, not great, but the fact that Simon Feld is in the mix, you know, he's kind of part of that crew, a guy who's, you know, doing camera for the Coen brothers back in the 80s and 90s. I just think that's a pretty neat, neat little bit of trivia.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, so we've talked about kind of how a good opener can also sometimes signify a strong summer, or in some cases the opposite, like the last year. But so in 2002, how does that season rate for you?
Well, it was another big disappointment year, because, I mean, it started out really strong with Spider-Man, and that was, in a way, like it should have been, but in a way it was kind of a big surprise, like how much people loved it and the numbers that it did. But that was shortly followed by Star Wars Episode II, Attack of the Clones, which was, I think, for most people, the worst of the Star Wars franchise as a whole. I think most people would even say it's even worse than Phantom Menace. I don't know, it's probably a toss-up for me between those two. But, yeah, it was a low point in the most beloved movie franchise of all time. So I guess if we get that during the summer, then it can't be great. And nobody wanted anything to do with Star Wars other than Spider-Man that month. So the rest of May was really, really dry. I mean, The Sum of All Fears was probably the biggest movie to come out in May after that. But then in June, you know, we get The Bourne Identity, which is another one that kind of sneaks up on us and becomes, you know, a big mega franchise after, you know, in retrospect, relative to the rest of the franchise, a relative hit, you know, or like a more modest hit than what would come later. We got movies like Scooby-Doo, Wind Talkers, the Disney movie was Lilo and Stitch, the Spielberg movie was Minority Report, the Sandler movie was Mr. Deeds, I mentioned Men in Black 2, and July was pretty sad. Road to Perdition was an interesting release just because it was an R-rated Tom Hanks anti-hero movie. But after that, we got a third Austin Powers movie, and then August is the biggest thing in August we got was Signs from Shyamalan Milan, and then Triple X, the Vin Diesel movie.
It's a hit in the summer for me. I mean, when I think about it, off the top of my head, I remember it being good. I think because of that strong opener, and then Minority Report, which I think is a great movie, and Signs, which I think is a great movie, and then you've got the Bourne Identity, which is a really fun movie. So I feel like it's got a pretty good, it's got some really good gems in there, but the low is really low. And I remember what was going through my head at the time was like, are action movies dead? And because like, you know, just a few years before, we were talking about Con Air and Face Off and these action movies that I loved so much. And this year, it was like, really, like, the Good Will Hunting guys are, like, our action stars now. And I was so down on both of those movies. I didn't see The Sum of All Fears, but I was really, really, I went into The Bourne Identity with my arms, you know, firmly folded, just expecting it to be really lame and boring. I was like, this little Matt Damon guy is going to be our next action hero, really. But of course it ended up being good. And that series has been one of the better action series of the last decade or so. So yeah, that's kind of where I was at. It was just like, you know, and then we had Triple X that year too. And it was very, just depressing in terms of a fan of action movies. Of course, later that year, we had Die Another Day, which is the most egregious James Bond movie. So there were some highlights, but yeah, it felt like, yeah, it's like whereas the Raimis and the Jacksons were riding high, it felt like all the things that made the 90s special in terms of like, you know, the blockbuster legends, like Spielberg, and then the action genre, those things were kind of going away. I mean, even I love Minority Report, and in a way, it's a really exciting Spielberg action movie. But at the same time, it's also very much about post 9/11 anxieties. So it's still that, you know, grown up Spielberg that it took some getting used to.
Yeah.
Yeah. Exactly. God. Lord, yeah. That pool scene is.
And to its credit. To its credit, 2002, the summer of 2002 is recovering from the summer of 2001, kind of finding its footing again in terms of, like, the blockbusters and the philosophy and the release schedule. And I think that it was obviously an improvement over the previous year, if not perfect.
Yeah, and it's funny for me because, like, whereas before, you know, summer was very much for me defined by Spielberg and those kind of movies, this was the year that Marvel kind of took over. I mean, that's how we started the discussion of 2002, and it's going to continue the next year. And it seems like for me in my, not that I should really care anymore because I'm an adult male with a family who pays taxes, but it does feel for me like, you know, the summer movie experience is in two halves at this point. It's post Jaws, you know, my childhood Spielberg kind of years in terms of generally speaking, and then it's Marvel. You know, those are the two forces, it's Spielberg, Amblin, and Marvel, that dominate the summer for me. And so the next year in 2003, we kick off with another huge Marvel hit, and they're totally hitting it at this point with X2, which I was hugely anticipating, and that paid off. I mean, when we're talking about our top five May openers, this is probably in the conversation for me for sure.
Yeah, it opened on May 2nd, 2003. It opened with the Lizzie McGuire movie, which was a Hilary Duff vehicle, or I guess an adaptation from a TV show she did. And I liked X2. It was really good. You know, I like the idea of a non-sequel kicking off this summer. I don't know, that's just a personal preference of mine, and it's not something like that we're guaranteed all the time, and there have been plenty of great sequels that have kicked off summers, and I hope that's the case in 2017, too, and X2 is really good. So, I mean, it's an exception to a personal rule, because if it's really good, it's good, and it can set a standard for the summer just as much as a quote-unquote original movie or a newly started franchise can. So I'm totally fine with it. And it finished with about $214 million that year domestic, and it's the top grosser that summer was actually Finding Nemo, big hit. It may have been the top grosser that year. I'll have to check on that, but I want to make a quick point about 2003, and it's really interesting, and this is kind of a broader 2003 thing than just the summer. I checked on all of these years to see, like, how the stat worked for each year. I wanted to see how many movies each year grossed $100 million or more domestically. And 29 movies in 2003 grossed $100 million or more. That, and to give you a little bit of context, that's the same exact number we got in 2015, and just one shy of it in 2016, and that had 30. So we're talking, you know, 14 years ago now, people were going to the movies. And what's crazy is, like, you saw a five movie decline the next year, and then the next 2 years, only 19 movies grossed $100 million or more. So 2003 was an incredible year in terms of movie going, and the fact that people just wanted to get out and check out. I guess, you know, the summer played a big part in that, because it was a major improvement in terms of the quality of movies we were getting, and the fact that in the volume of good movies that we were getting, and also we saw beefed up franchises starting to sort of, like, figure out what they were doing, and they were starting to make better sequels than we were used to.
Yeah, I feel like this is when we started getting, you know, there was, you know, blockbusters, but now we were getting, like, these freaking massive, you know, like, everything has to be the biggest thing, you know, and I think I have to keep going back to Lord of the Rings, you know, it just felt big, just the way it used movie magic, the way it permeated the culture, and the way that it was too big for itself. You know, it's like, here's a movie that's so big it has to be three movies, and every one of them is going to be an event. And so guess what? For the next 3 years, you're guaranteed a Star Wars level event movie every year. And then all the other studios said, well, okay, I guess we got to start doing that too. So then, you know, the Marvel movies cranked up and I remember the conversation in 2005 was like, are movies dying? seems like there's not as many people going to movie theaters, and then you have a year, you know, like the last few we've had, so it's like funny what people get scared of. But yeah, 2003 was a really, really strong year at the box office, and for me, I think I really liked a lot of the major releases. I think it still had some of the weird, rough spots that 2002 had, but again, in terms of that transition, I feel like this is maybe the year we got, what, Hollywood Homicide?
Yep, saw that at the theater.
And Lara Croft 2. So I feel like those are both, like, vestiges of a different time period. But also, I mean, I think we get Marvel flexing their muscles a little bit. They open strong with the sequel that they know is going to do well. But they also experiment, and they release Hulk, which was that also in May?
Hulk was in, I believe, June. Yeah, Hulk was June.
Okay.
So
what else is in May? Do you have a pretty?
Survey the rest of the summer. We've got Daddy Daycare. I didn't see that, but big movie-wise, we've got The Matrix
Classic.
Reloaded, which was a big deal for me, and I loved
Ooh.
It. I think one of the better action movies.
That was a big deal for everybody.
Yeah, big deal, yeah, in general, but just, like, I know that there's some backlash and a lot of people pick to it with the third movie, but I think it's right there with the first one, and strictly from an action standpoint, and I think it stuck to a lot of the mystery that people found really interesting, and the world building was still pretty fresh and cool, and so I'm a big Matrix Reloaded fan. I mean, that freaking highway action sequence is out of this world.
I totally disagree. That action scene is great. It was actually on TV last night, and my wife and I, like, put it on for, like, 5 minutes, and it was, like, you know, some scene in Zion where people are talking about, like, you know, family drama, and I was just
the Zion stuff is the worst.
This is so bad.
Yeah, I hate the Zion stuff so
real
much.
Bad.
I mean, I'm like, I'd rather live in the Matrix, to be honest with you, to go against the point of the whole thing.
There's
a whole Zion raid scene, which, you know, we don't have to talk about, but yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's as good of a movie as The Matrix, and it doesn't have as much depth, and it's not as, philosophically minded, even though it does its best, and it doesn't execute that the same way, but the action, I think, is just as good, if not better, than what we get in the first Matrix movie. So that scores a lot of points for me when I'm at a summer movie. So, the rest of the summer, we get Bruce Almighty, sort of like, I would say, like, the last really big Jim Carrey comedy vehicle that did really well. Finding Nemo,
yeah.
the Italian Job, Too Fast, Too Furious. They're starting to build there and gain some momentum. You've got Hollywood Homicide, you mentioned. You've got Hulk in June. 28 Days Later, a very interesting release. Not a blockbuster, but very interesting that summer. Charlie's Angels, Full Throttle, action-packed sequel there. Another one from McGee. And we get into July, you get a Legally Blonde sequel. You get Terminator 3, Rise of the Machines. You get the first Pirates of the Caribbean movie, which is going to be a global phenomenon. There for another one for Disney. Bad Boys 2 comes out, a big disappointment for me. Lara Croft sequel, like you mentioned. Seabiscuit, and then you get the August decline, or the August drop-off that, you know, in not to pound on 2003 here, but Geely came out during August, SWAT came out, Freddy versus Jason, I'm running out of steam here in 2003.
Yeah, so. I feel like X versus Sever maybe was in there somewhere.
The
Ballistic, X versus Seven.
Ballistic movie?
Ballistic?
I don't see that. I don't see that. Are you sure that was 2003?
Okay.
No.
Maybe
not.
That was 2002. I feel like that was an August movie, so yeah. I can't believe it didn't come up before this. Anyway. But yeah, it was definitely, but in terms of, like, for me, again, like, I loved Terminator 3 whenever it came out. I mean, you talked about the Matrix highway chase. The crane chase in Terminator 3 is just one of the most fun things to see on a big screen, and it's by far the highlight of that movie. It's just so destructive and satisfying. But yeah, I remember reading about Pirates of the Caribbean and thinking like, well, this sounds really cool, but I mean, nobody's going to see this, right? And whenever I like walked out of the theater and it was just like, I was like surrounded by an ocean of people and everybody was buzzing about it. I was like, oh, okay. Well, that's cool. Like that, I like that a lot, and I'm glad everybody else did too. I feel like going in the summer, nobody would have ever suspected that was going to be, you know, one of the bigger movies.
Graham and I were on a road trip out to Washington State, and we made a stop in Missoula, Montana, and got a motel and had some time to kill, and we went and saw Pirates of the Caribbean at a Missoula, Montana theater, and we had a good time. We both thought it was pretty good, and I think it holds up fine. It's the best.
Absolutely.
One of the
it's a very, very fun. Disagree, but we'll get there. But it's it's very fun. But yeah. So moving on, I think unless you have anything else to add about 2003.
I hated Terminator 3. I thought it was terrible at the time. I think it's terrible now. I don't know how you can forgive something that has talk to the hand, which I think was a 5 years too late reference.
Here's the only funny thing is that he actually does it. He actually like leans into it. As if it's a microphone, but yeah, the movie has some really, really super lame parts, and you know, maybe super lame on the whole. That's fair enough. But I was very excited for it, and so I'll admit that you know that blinded me a little bit, and then the parts that work really work for me. But yeah, I saw a lot that summer, I even saw the Tomb Raider sequel. So I was firmly back, and like you've mentioned earlier with the, yeah, it was real bad. Yon DeBaan. You mentioned earlier with just the whole movie phenomenon and box office tracking. I mean, this is where I kind of went nuclear in terms of all of that stuff, of just paying attention to box office and movies and upcoming movies. I was right back to where I was, you know, when I was a kid tracking this stuff and I was starting college. So by 2004, summer 2004, I was like anticipating the premiere issue, you know, that the every year premiere had their issue of like the summer movie previews. And so I was anticipating, I remember like in Tuscaloosa going to the Suncoast, I think it was called Suncoast, right? The movie, like music place in the mall there. Am I remembering that correctly?
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember going in there like weeks before the premiere issue was supposed to be released, or you know, I found out it was going to be released. And I was just like, "Dadgum!" Like they don't have. Where's that issue? Like that's all I want to do is buy that magazine, take it to class, and ignore the teacher while I read about the upcoming movies. And so I was hyped for Van Helsing, which was the May opener that year. Steven Sommers trying to redeem himself after The Mummy Returns, and I had kind of high hopes for it. Hugh Jackman had kind of proven himself to be a strong, you know, the movie lead, and it was a neat idea. I still think it's kind of a neat idea to, you know, combine all the movie monsters and have them fight this one hero guy. And when I watched the movie, I gave it a big pass, and I said, you know, it's dumb, but it's got a big CGI werewolf fighting a big CGI bat or monster or something like that in it. So it's hard to hate. So I was very, I was blinded by my enthusiasm for the summer movie season of 2004 and accepted Van Helsing. I'm assuming you're more sober-minded than I was.
I actually skipped Van Helsing. I didn't see it in the theater. Actually, I went and saw something else. I'm not exactly sure what it was. If I'm looking at the order of the release dates here, it may have been Mean Girls that I've seen in the theater. I can't remember if they're in the same theater or not. But I walked in, or Man on Fire maybe, I don't know. I walked into the Van Helsing theater, and it was, I don't know, maybe two-thirds of the way through it. And I just looked in on it and watched it for like 5 minutes, and I thought, yep, I made the right decision. I'm saving my money. This sucks. Like, and it sucks because I liked The Mummy so much, and I thought maybe he got Mummy Returns out of his system and knows that it wasn't good, and he needed to course correct. And unfortunately, I felt like Van Helsing had way more in common with The Mummy Returns than it did The Mummy, and I skipped it. And in fact, there was a lot this summer that I skipped. I mean, I still saw a lot, but I was starting college. I had just finished my first semester at UA, and I probably had less money than I was used to, because I'm sure I had to fend for myself a little more than I was used to. So I probably just saw movies less. I was working at the college newspaper, and so, you know, there's just a little more going on in my life. And so it just made me think, like, okay, maybe less movies, because, you know, but if there was a movie I thought was worth seeing, I would definitely go. And there were movies in the next couple of weeks that I saw, and I would review movies for the college newspaper. So I did have reasons to go, but again, I was being way more selective, I think, with my time and my money, and I think Van Helsing was probably pretty symbolic of that. So I think it was a pretty poor way to start off the year. One of the worst up there with, or down there with, The Mummy Returns, and it's unfortunate that there's a common denominator there.
Just a quick aside, I remember one of our first kind of extended conversations about movies was in a class together earlier that spring, where you were very enthusiastic about The Punisher.
No way.
Yeah, you were enthusiastic about the fight that he has with Kevin Nash, I believe.
Yes, that's a great scene.
It's a decent scene, but then it's like cross cut with comedy. It's a bad movie. Real bad.
Yeah, I think I gave it a positive review in like the newspaper. Maybe that's what you took issue with. I don't know.
Bad call.
No.
Anyway. But it is noteworthy that this is post kind of film nerds era at this point. You know, you, me, obviously you and Graham had met sometime before this, I think. But then we met, and then through Graham and Matt as well. And then later on, Craig crept his way in. So this is kind of getting to be the height of film nerd.
Rise of the film nerd.
Rise of the origins. Film nerd's origins. God. Anyway, I was blinded for Van Helsing, but then Troy was a few weeks after that, I believe, 2 weeks. And
1 week.
One week. Good Lord. I was so excited for Troy. It looked like another Gladiator. It looked awesome. The trailer was really cool. It had Eric Bana, who I thought was a really good leading man. Brad Pitt was kind of, you know, hitting his stride as a leading man. I was hyped, and I saw it and did not like it. And it was a huge disappointment for me. Where are you at on Troy?
I liked it overall. I remember being disappointed by it because, like you, I thought, yeah, this could be as good, if not better, than Gladiator. It could be the biggest type of this movie we've ever seen. And then I guess I didn't realize like how low its ceiling was, and it can only be so good, just in terms of its script and a lot of the acting in it. And I like Brad Pitt just fine, but he was kind of stiff in it, and it was disappointing too, just in terms of the context leading up to it. I think wasn't Troy the movie that he spurned Darren Aronofsky on for The Fountain? He left The Fountain to make,
yes,
Troy.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
I believe Wolfgang Peterson walked off of Batman Superman, Superman movie for this.
Yeah, so not, you know, I don't love Troy. I certainly don't love The Fountain either, so I guess that was kind of a, not a lose-lose, but certainly not a win-win. So I think Troy is fine. It was on TV recently, and I thought, this isn't the worst. You know, Peter O'Toole's good in it. Eric Bana's good in it. There's some good fights. There's some interesting staging in terms of, like, the big spectacle action happening here. So I don't hate Troy. I certainly don't.
Also, since we keep mentioning wrestlers and movies, it has Nathan Jones in it.
yeah, and you mentioned Kevin Nash, and, you know, that was probably a big win for me, because I like the crossover. This keeps coming up. This is bad.
Weird. Very bad. I agree. We'll keep moving on. So, what's the rest of that summer look like? And I might pipe in with, because
sure, so we get,
this may be a bad summer, but go ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. We'll see. Yeah, probably, now that I'm looking at the list. Shrek 2, hated it. The Day After Tomorrow, skipped
Boo.
It. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, arguably the best Bat franchise, you know, perhaps. maybe. Chronicles of Riddick.
Ooh.
Garfield the movie. Napoleon Dynamite. Big, not a blockbuster, but certainly a big sleeper word of mouth.
I feel like that didn't really enter the conversation until the fall for me. Like I caught up with it late, but that I've never thought of as a summer movie. Really,
it wasn't a summer movie.
Okay, all right. Well, for me, it wasn't until I got back to college and started talking. You know, then I realized this phenomenon. You know, apparently that I missed back home. But yes,
the Stepford Wives, Around the World in 80 Days.
Arnold Schwarzenegger's. You know, one of his rare movies while in office.
Right. Good choice, too. Dodgeball, True Underdog, or just Dodgeball, we'll skip that subtitle. The Spielberg movie was The Terminal,
yes,
which should have been released on Thanksgiving Day or Christmas Day.
Not a summer movie.
Yeah. The Notebook, Spider-Man 2 came out.
There you go.
June 30th there. King Arthur, another big score for you, I know.
Win.
Came out. Anchorman. One of my favorite movies of that summer. Laughed my ass off and always do whenever I watch it. Catwoman came out, unfortunately. iRobot.
Oh, man. I totally forgot that movie existed. Not a bad movie, you know? It's just there.
Yeah, I think that's the case for a lot of these Will Smith movies we might be talking about. The Bourne Supremacy, everybody loves that.
Awesome.
Garden State was also one of these little movies that popped up that people I didn't care for Garden State.
I was huge into Garden State. It was
man. What was her name?
Lord. Don't even let's not get it. We've gotten too personal already. We don't need to go there.
The Manchurian Candidate, RIP.
I've been meaning to rewatch that for the last several months because I saw it in the theater. And thought, I didn't really like it, but now...
God, it's got a damn good cast, I know that.
Yeah, Denzel, with Resistance, I feel like
Meryl
it's probably a lot better.
Yeah, Lee Denzel, Schreiber. Meryl Streep, Liev Schreiber, John Voight, good grief. The Village came out at the end of July.
Awesome.
Collateral.
Awesome, wow, okay, never mind. This summer's great.
that kind of does it. The rest of August after Collateral is pretty...
I was definitely back at college when I saw Collateral. So, yeah, that's like, I almost lumped that in because, I lumped that almost into like award season a little bit just because it doesn't feel like a summer movie, really. But
no, it was August 5th.
Yeah,
so,
it's definitely
summer
movie. Yeah.
Yeah. Feel like that. But then you get into bad franchise movies like Princess Diaries 2, Alien vs. Predator, Exorcist the Beginning, Anaconda's The Hunt for the Blood Orchid, and then you're like, okay, back to school.
Yeah. Let me forget about movies again for a few months. Okay, so look, you got Azkaban, you've got Spider-Man, Bourne Supremacy, and Collateral, and Anchorman. So for me, that's a pretty strong year right there.
Yeah.
Maybe not one of the strongest, but yeah, it's a good summer. So my mistake. So the next year, I was again very, very hyped for the May opener, which was a bit of a change in pace, but it definitely had a precedent. It was Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven, which I loved when I saw it in the theater and then thought about it and said, you know, there's definitely some missing parts, so maybe I'll back off of it. And then down the road, I saw the extended cut and loved it again. But I think I'm probably in the minority. And I definitely agree that it's not exactly, you know, May opener material.
No, it was a bad choice, really. Like, seriously. And I remember thinking at the time that it was unusual just because I don't know, like, it just seemed like weird. The historical epic about the Crusades just seemed like a really strange choice to kick off the summer, and it was 2 weeks before Revenge of the Sith came out. So it didn't have a ton of competition, but that didn't really matter. It only ended up grossing $47 million overall, which is like, domestic, just like way down the list of the annual grossers. So it was at least a domestic flop. I'd have to check on its worldwide gross. And then there are people out there like you who like the director's cut or whatever and like gave that the time of day. I didn't bother. But the movie's fine. I think it's fine. I just thought, like, it's really, it should probably have just been a Starz series, you know? But that was before the...
Brutal. Wow.
That was before the Starz, you know, took off.
You wanted Kingdom of Heaven, Blood and Sand. I would highly recommend checking out the Ultimate Cut, or whatever the hell it's called, on the biggest screen you can find, because it's one of Ridley Scott's best movies, but we don't have to linger on that. But yeah, go through this summer, because I remember loving a lot this summer. This was a really fun year for me, as I recall.
Yeah, so the Will Ferrell comedy Kicking and Screaming, which I think is kind of fun.
It's Star very
Wars,
underrated.
Revenge of the Sith, which you loved.
Loved it.
Madagascar. The Sandler movie was The Longest Yard.
Oh, that's right.
The another movie that should have been released on Thanksgiving Day or Christmas Day, Cinderella Man in the Dead Center of Summer. Just a terrible release date for a really good movie.
Especially in 2005. You know, had it been 1995 when one of the best summer movies was Apollo 13, you know,
right.
I feel like that would have been great. But yeah, in 2005, if it's not Batman or a Pixar movie or a Marvel movie, it's like, I hate that these things are getting overlooked, but yeah, I agree. Cinderella Man is a really, really one of Ron Howard's strongest movies.
Yep, underrated. In June, there's Mr. and Mrs. Smith. There's Batman Begins.
Yeah.
There's War of the Worlds later.
Yeah, there you go.
Spielberg movie. In July, we get Fantastic Four. We get Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. Wedding Crashers. Michael Bay's movie was The Island.
Loved it.
Got The Dukes of Hazzard in August. Transporter 2. Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo. I guess the best thing that came out at this point was not really a blockbuster, but it was successful, the 40-year-old version. So that,
that was a big deal. I remember for a lot of my friends, you know, it was, I guess, on the strength of Anchorman, really, you know, which was an Apatow production and had a Steve Carell, and he was kind of like right on the verge of blowing up. So I remember that being a big deal. So I would totally count that in as one of the big summer movies that year. But yeah, I mean, a good year, especially for me. I mean, again, a personal note, this is the year my wife and I started dating, and our first, we went to see Revenge of the Sith and War of the Worlds together as friends, and then our first official date was Fantastic Four. So we're making it work.
Smooth operator.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, I mean, look, Batman Begins, War of the Worlds, for me, Revenge of the Sith, for sure. Like you said, 40-year-old virgin. There's a lot of really great, fun stuff in here. And even Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you know, I it's not a great movie, but there's a lot of fun to be had with it. So, yeah, this was a strong one for me.
Yeah, okay, but, you know, it's marred by a bad Star Wars movie, and I know you like Sith, and I'll give it the credit as being the best prequel movie, but we know what that amounts to, really. Like, thank God we've been able to, you know, distance ourselves with years and now Star Wars movies from that, so I don't know, like, whenever a prequel movie came out, I hate to lump the rest of the summer in with it, but it's definitely the biggest deal from that year and how I'll remember it. And that 2005 ended up getting a lot better for me just in terms of like what came out that fall. I mean, there was just an incredibly high volume of great movies that came out. It's a really, really good movie year, and most of the good stuff came out starting in the fall.
I mean, look, the summer has Batman, Spielberg, and Star Wars. So even though none of those are the strongest in any of those entries and any of those series or whatever, I still feel like it's notable. And
well, we got an even better Spielberg movie later in the year, you know?
Absolutely. It's a double Spielberg year, so it's a great year in movies, just like 2002.
Right.
Well, so 2006 was... kind of an odd opening movie, franchise that had been pretty quiet for a while, but ended up being a really nice kickoff and a decent little summer. It's of course, and it's another kind of big summer debut, and really a feature film debut by J.J. Abrams, when that's Mission Impossible 3. So it's kind of, you know, Tom Cruise trying to stay on top and, you know, really for the last time, for a while at least, doing so. Mission Impossible 3 is one of those movies that, looking back on it, feels so small. But it's a really satisfying May movie. Does that make any sense? Like, in terms of, like, it has the same, you know, intangible that The Mummy has for me, where it just picks up and starts and then ends, and it's like, wow, I had a great time, and I didn't even realize, you know, 2 hours had passed. And are we on the same page?
I guess. I mean, I knew it was, like, in the moment, I'm like, okay, this is a big Mission Impossible movie. This is a huge franchise, right? And it's been, like, 6 years since the last one came out, so maybe that was just enough distance between the two of those movies for us to sort of, like, recalibrate and let it start fresh. And not that this was, like, not that it was a reboot, necessarily, but in a way it kind of was. You know, it was
absolutely
kind of a shot in the arm.
Sure.
For the franchise. But I know that you think, like, it, J.J. Abrams, you know, this is his directorial debut. I know you think, like, he is sort of relying on a lot of his TV sensibilities, but it still has a lot of, like, large-scale action. I mean, that,
sure,
that
absolutely.
Sequence is freaking awesome. And,
great.
And it's got, you know, Philip Seymour Hoffman, which is sort of, like, lends innate cinematic gravitas to whatever he's a part of, and Tom Cruise is still Tom Cruise.
Tom Cruise, yeah.
It had everything it needed going for it. And, you know, surprisingly, it only made, like, $130 million at the box office, you know, this big Tom Cruise action movie. And certainly that would give way to the next couple, or the next few, a couple of Mission Impossible movies that would just do gangbusters at the box office. So that's interesting, sort of what it did for its franchise, just in terms of re-energizing not only the franchise but the audience, and re-familiarizing the audience with A, Tom Cruise, and B, these characters in this franchise moving forward. And this was also, it was also tricky because, was it Mission Impossible 3 or was it War of the Worlds when Tom Cruise had his whole, like, you know, couch jumping Katie Holmes?
So
spying, like, that whole, when was that whole backstory?
That was, I think that was during PR on War of the Worlds. And that, from what I understand, put a rift between he and Spielberg and definitely scuttled this movie. And probably cost this movie at least $50 million, if not more. So this was definitely post, weirdo cruise, and so I think people reacted.
And it kicked off with, it opened that weekend with a small horror movie called An American Haunting, and then another movie called Hoot, which I think was animated. No,
probably.
Wait, was Hoot animated? No, it was not. It was a children's film.
That's good. By the way, just so you know, the title of this episode will be, was Hoot animated?
Rightly so.
I remember, yeah, it was definitely a low-key movie, and I remember watching it again in the Dollar Theater at the Bama 6, like, whenever school kicked up, and thinking, wow, this movie works so well. Like, it's so fun. But, yeah, it was definitely, it felt like a low-key movie compared to what was really probably the biggest release that May, and the biggest, when one of the biggest debacles of that year, X-Men The Last Stand. But so go through the schedule a little bit, because I'm probably, I know the Da Vinci Code is in there somewhere.
Yeah,
like, Over the Hedge, maybe.
Yeah, you're on the right track. So after Mission Impossible 3, Poseidon came out. After Poseidon, no, I don't think I've met anybody that's seen the movie Poseidon. Have you?
No, never.
Okay,
no,
there you go. After that was The Da Vinci Code and Over the Hedge, plus See No Evil, starring Kane, who's now the
possible
candidate. I know, I'm sorry. And then after that, X-Men The Last Stand, which I watched recently and is actually not bad. It's really not. So
it is.
We move into June, and we get The Breakup, the romantic comedy. The Pixar movie that year was Cars. Yeah. Then we get, for some reason, the Robert Altman movie, his final movie, A Prairie Home Companion, gets a wide
That's
release.
Right.
That year, Fast and Furious Tokyo Drift comes out that year. There's a Garfield sequel. There's Nacho Libre, which is, I think, beloved in the film nerd circle. I certainly love it. It's one of my all-time favorite movies. The Adam Sandler movie is Click, which made my brother cry. The Superman Returns opened.
Yes.
This summer.
That was it.
So the whole summer was probably built around that. So
oh,
the whole
absolutely.
Year, possibly.
The whole year, absolutely. This was the year of Superman for me.
Okay, we'll get back to it. After that, The Devil Wears Prada. Then there's Pirates of the Caribbean, Dead Man's Chest. There's
huge.
Clerks 2, Lady in the Water, the Shyamalan movie. There's Little Miss Sunshine, which is an indie, but worth noting. There's Miami Vice. There's Talladega Nights, World Trade Center. That probably does it. Oh, and Snakes on a Plane comes out later in August. So, yeah, I mean, looking back, I guess, yeah, just looking at all these movies. Yeah, the Da Vinci Code was huge. You mentioned X-Men. Superman, obviously, was a big deal. I know that was the biggest for you. But, I mean, looking back, Mission Impossible 3 is probably my favorite from that year.
Nacho Libre, other than Nacho Libre.
Other than Nacho Libre, yeah. Just in terms of, like, the big blockbusters, I don't think I've seen Nacho Libre in the same category.
Yeah, I remember it was, I mean, looking back, it was not that great. I mean, Mission Impossible 3 was a ton of fun. Superman Returns, I loved. But, again, it was kind of that thing where I was like, well, I love this, but I can't talk about it because not everybody else loves it. or when I do talk about it, I just get in fights with people. And then Dead Man's Chest was a huge disappointment for me. I think looking back, it's not a bad movie by any stretch of the imagination, but it is what it is. And that's about it. Yeah, I feel like it was, I saw almost all of these, except for Poseidon, because I'm a human being, and no human being saw that. But I think I saw almost all of these, and none of them really, really stuck with me at all, including Over the Hedge and Cars, which, but I remember a lot of times in this summer walking out and being like, well, okay, I mean, if you do this and you think about that, it's not bad, you know? And that's kind of damning if that's what you keep doing every weekend for an entire summer.
Pirates of the Caribbean, yeah, that was the highest grosser of the year. It made $420 million plus. I hated it. I didn't like it at all. I thought it was a step down from the first movie. And I think at that point I decided, like, look, if this is what the Pirates movies are going to be from now on, I think I'm just done with it. So
I remember getting in an argument with somebody. Basically, like, I saw the dichotomy between the failure of Superman Returns and the success of Pirates of the Caribbean 2 as this huge cultural problem. Because I was like, on one hand, you have this, like, fairly wholesome movie about a guy, you know, wrestling with his own place in the world and his own fatherhood and dealing with that. And they're both love triangle movies, you know, and, like, this Superman Returns is a love triangle movie where everybody is, like, struggling with it and everybody's a good person and they're just trying to figure out how to make this work. And then The Dead Man's Chest, which was way more successful, it's just people screaming at each other and double-crossing each other and Keira Knightley falling in love with Johnny Depp for no reason other than the fact that he's Johnny Depp. And all this is just kind of like ugly, like, I don't know, just it felt like those two movies were fighting for the affection of the United States of America. And obviously the uglier, more bloated movie won, as is what happens in this country. But so now that I'm having that argument again with myself, I was dead on at the time. So, yep.
Were you as depressed as the Superman Bryan Singer portrayed in Superman Returns?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. I was like Brandon Routh floating above the earth, just staring. it was dark.
Yeah, so, I mean, that should have marked, like, the emergence of Brandon Routh, right? And that didn't happen.
Sure didn't. I mean, look, he's great in Scott Pilgrim, right?
Yeah. What's that, a five-minute scene? And, like, I like I think he's great in that, too. I do. And I thought he was fine as Superman. I thought he was fine, you know?
Look, I think he is a huge missed opportunity. Obviously, I'm a big mark for that, for Superman Returns. But I think, in general, Brandon Routh is a really strong actor and just kind of – there's a Superman curse, unfortunately, you know, in terms of getting typecast and not really finding anything after you do that. So I feel like he's a victim of that. And if somebody came along and actually gave him a shot at doing something that isn't bad, I think he would do well. But that's maybe another 3-hour podcast that we could do sometime.
Oof. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe Craig will do it with you.
So the next year, Marvel steps back up to the plate and opens it with one of their most anticipated movies maybe ever. After Spider-Man 2, you know, everybody loved that movie. It was, you know, heralded as one of the best superhero movies of all time at the time. Some people still say that. And so Spider-Man 3 was just, like, obvious, you know. This is going to be great. It's going to have Venom in it. It's going to be Sam Raimi's closed his trilogy. The first two were wonderful. And then it came out, and it opened the summer, and it made a tremendous amount of money, but nobody liked it. So that was 2007.
Yep, May 4th, 2007. It opened with Lucky You, that big flop gambling movie with Eric Bana, and yeah. It was the highest grosser of 2007. It made about nearly $340 million that year. So despite, you know, I think the consensus, most people just didn't like it, but enough people wanted to see it, and I guess wanted to see it again a couple times, that they forced it into the top spot that year. And what's weird about that movie is that it's fine. You know, I'd go back to my sequel thing, but I'm fine with Spider-Man 3 kicking off the summer movie season. I remember, yeah. I skipped it at the theater. I did. Like, I don't know why. It just happens sometimes. Didn't have time. I don't know. And I saw it on DVD, and I remember, like, 45 minutes into it thinking, what's everybody's problem? Like, this is actually really good. Like, the story's working, you know, the villains are working, the special effects are incredible, like, and then things start happening, and like,
yep.
You know, I think there's obviously the big turning point for most people is either, like, I don't know if it's the Venom stuff or when he starts dancing. I'm guessing when he starts dancing is when it happens, and then, it loses control. Like, there's just so much on the table that Raimi, as accomplished as he is, and, you know, I don't know if he does his best. I don't know if he was losing interest or what, but there was just too much going on. It was out of control. How many villains are there? So there's Venom, there's Sandman, there's Harry Osborn becoming the new Green Goblin. Am I missing anybody?
The Mary Jane is basically a villain.
Is Spider-Man the villain?
Is there. Yeah, I mean, it's so much going on. But, yeah, you're right. It's like, I watched it. I mean, it was in the theater, it's one of my, I'm sure we talked about it, it was one of my, like, most painful movie theater experiences because, I had to use the bathroom, like, an hour in, and I walked out thinking, this movie is fantastic, and then I came back in, and I was like, oh, my God, what happened?
What happened in that bathroom, man?
Yeah, what did I do? But I watched it again recently, a few years ago, and, man, you're right, like, those action scenes, especially that rescue sequence where he's rescuing Gwen Stacy from the crane and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, you can tell that's where Sam Raimi was working. You know, like, the studio was coming in and giving him all this crap to push him into the script and all the, you know, all the characters. And he was like, whatever. I'm like, yes, I'll do that. Leave me alone so I can go put together these action sequences the way I want them to look. And that's kind of his contribution to the movie, and everything else is just Sony basically, you know, running roughshod over this franchise, which is still something that's happening today. But the it was, in a way, it's not surprising that it's so financially successful, because out of the three Spider-Man movies, I feel like this is probably the one that little kids would go see the most. You know, like, I could totally see myself as a 10-year-old wanting to see this movie, like, every week during the summer, just because of those fun and wacky action scenes and the funny dancing. In a strange way, I totally understand why this one is so successful. So, this ended up being a massive summer, and I'll let you go through the schedule, but just off the top, I mean, it started with, like, the overpacked 9-hour-long Spider-Man 3, and I feel like this is the first modern movie summer in a way, you know, where you have, like, we talked earlier about, like, the mega summer blockbuster that is just too big for its own, too big to fail in its own way. And this summer, it feels like we had one of those every weekend almost.
Yeah, so nothing the week after Spider-Man 3. I mean, you had small movies like 28 Weeks Later, Delta Force, The Georgia Rule. But then after that, the next week you get Shrek the Third. The next week you get Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End, the third in that franchise.
Best one.
After that you get Knocked Up. After that you get Ocean's 13. After that you get Rise of the Silver Surfer. Then you get Evan Almighty, Live Free or Die Hard, as they're contractually obligated to include. Then you get the Pixar movie is Ratatouille, one of their all-time bests. Then you get into July, Transformers, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, my least favorite Harry Potter movie, for what it's worth. Hairspray, I know Craig's saying it ain't worth shit. Hairspray. the Sandler movie is I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry. The Simpsons movie came out that summer. Then you get The Bourne Ultimatum, another third movie. Super underrated comedy, not a blockbuster. Hot Rod came out that year. Really strong year for comedy. Yeah, Superbad, I think, comes out. Yeah, Superbad comes out a little later. Rush Hour 3, another third movie. Crazy trend here. And that about does it.
So, obviously, peters out, but, I mean, when you've got a summer where a Harry Potter film feels like an afterthought, that's a pretty big deal, in my opinion, because I always forget that that movie even came out that year, and I saw it in the theaters. It's good, by the way. It's really good. It's not one of the best, but it's definitely not one of the worst. But, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of huge, huge stuff in there. Like you said, a lot of third movies, which is oftentimes the most overstuffed and kind of overcooked of any franchise, but also a lot of long, like a lot of highly anticipated long gestating projects came out that year. I mean, Transformers is a movie that had been rumored for so many years, and you finally got it, and it was a massive deal. I mean, I think arguably maybe, obviously Spider-Man 3 made the most money that year, but I feel like Transformers is kind of the movie of the summer, for better or worse. But also you have a Die Hard sequel, and you have the last Bourne movie for a while. And, yeah, it was, in my opinion, it was a really good summer. I mean, you've got Pirates of the Caribbean, which I think is fantastic. I think it's the best of the series. It's exciting. It's weird. It's a guy that has unlimited power over his movie, doing everything he wants to do, and the story is strong and it wraps up nicely, and so there's that. You had a huge Pixar movie. I think Die Hard was a satisfying action movie. The Harry Potter movie was good. I think it ended up being and like you said, the comedy, Superbad and especially Hot Rod, very funny movies. Knocked Up was great. I think Silver Surfer is a huge improvement on the other movie. There's so much to talk about this summer, and a lot of it is good. It is unfortunately that one of the more high profile ones, Transformers, is god awful.
Yeah, well, I mean, so in a way, Spider-Man 3 is like the perfect setup for 2007.
Absolutely. It's a really good, synopsis of that whole summer. What was your favorite of that bunch?
Of that summer?
Yeah. I remember you and I were really arguing a lot in this period of time.
The next year is when we really get into it.
Oh, good lord.
We'll get there, and it might start again. But, yeah, that's when it really, really escalated. My favorite out of all that, I love Ocean's 13, man. Ratatouille is my favorite for sure. Like, Ratatouille, I think Ratatouille is my favorite movie of that entire year, so I would go Ratatouille.
Yeah, fair. I mean, yeah, again, like, I failed to mention Ocean's 13 earlier. What a fun movie, you know? So it's just a really good mix of all sorts of stuff this summer, and, I mean, you know, again, personally, I it's just like the longest beach vacation me and my wife has ever taken. We, like, you know, stayed with a bunch of friends and, like, went to the beach. And, like, while we were there, we watched Die Hard and Transformers in the theater. And, like, I don't know. It was just, like, this was, like, one of the biggest summers for me in terms of just, like, making sure I saw everything and just doing a bunch of, like, fun stuff. But then I started making movies, and then I got married and had a kid, and so I don't have fun anymore.
For more Film Nerds Unlimited, go to filmnerds.com or find us on Facebook and Twitter. If you like what you hear, rate and review our podcast on iTunes. Keep an eye out for the next issue of Film Nerds Unlimited, coming soon.